Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the exploration of our evolving culture, the nature of who we are, and how we really are opening up to new worlds and new realities. And tonight, I'm very happy to have as my guest, Carrie Cassidy of the Project Camelot, and she is putting on an amazing conference this coming weekend, April 5th, 6th, and 7th in Glendale, California, the Awaken Aware Time Travel in Other Worlds, and the website. What's the website for that, Carrie?
Hi, Alan.
Hi.
It is Awake and Aware, spelling out the words, 2013.net.
Great. And I'm sure people have heard of Carrie Cassidy's Project Camelot if you're listening to this program, because in a way, we interview a lot of the same guests, but I think from a different perspective. I mean, the perspective that you take, Carrie, I think is more getting out the truth, getting to the real nature of what's happening. And I feel like I'm going from the angle of what is consciousness that's connected to that. I mean, they overlap and intersect, but do you know what I'm saying? Like, your approach is real, like, hardcore news media, getting to the truth of what's going on. I mean, would you characterize your work that way?
Sure. I do think they overlap. There's no doubt about it. Consciousness is heavily involved.
Right.
As is with everything. But we do come at it specifically, though. We specialize in whistleblower testimony, and that is whistleblowers from above top secret, which is pretty unique. In fact, I would venture to say we're the only group of people, only website out there that specializes in that. That's how we started out, and we were just sort of all about getting the truth out from above top secret about the secret government and so on and so forth. So whereas we do interview some people that are kind of more into, I guess, consciousness explorers, however you want to look at that, people like Graham Hancock, for example. We're having Bashar speak at my conference, but we really do specialize in kind of, as you called it, a bit of the more hardcore stuff, the stuff that really has to do with what's going on here on planet Earth and in the everyday, 3D and then going into other dimensions, because you can't get around the old multidimensional quality of what we're interacting with here.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think what you're doing in a way is more practical. I guess I'm more philosophical in a sense, but I think it's important to be grounded in the fact that these cover-ups, these secret government projects exist, and that's another way of shifting the consciousness. Absolutely. So I just wanted to tell people that this Awake and Aware show is going to have a real host of amazing speakers there, and I'm helping to MC. I'm very happy about that. Definitely Bashar, who is one of my favorite multidimensional beings, is going to be there, and David Wilcox and Richard Hoagland, Anthony Sanchez, Sean David Morton. I mean, you have a real great cast of characters, I have to say, and the overall theme is time travel, but also kind of digging deeper, like what is going on behind these secret projects. Would you say that there's a deeper theme than just the word time travel?
Sure. And for those of you who are not familiar with Project Camelot, I encourage people to go to my website, which is projectcamelot.org or projectcamelotportal.com. Both URLs will get you to the same place. And we have over 300 hours of audio and video footage, interviews with basically experiencers, authors, and then again, scientists and engineers and others from above top secret clearances who have decided to break their security oath in order to get the truth out to people. So these are people that are risking their lives to get the truth out. And that's what we're all about. And the conference will have some whistleblowers at the conference, specifically Henry Deacon, who has also come out under his own name now, Arthur Neumann, who was an above top secret scientist working for Livermore Labs. And he basically states that he has been to Mars, and is, you know, actually did this long before Bishago ever came out to the fore. So it's a whole different ball game. We also deal with super soldiers, for example, and so on.
Well, you know, the question I really wanted to ask you, and I'm really happy you're as a guest here, is how did you get started in this? What was the first, you know, we're brought up in a pretty mainstream American culture, we're force-fed television and the commercials, but what was the first inkling that things were not how we were told it was? For you, what was your awakening?
That's interesting. No, I have to say that I really came to the planet questioning everything. I was sort of unusual in that respect. I was a real rebel since I was a kid. Talked back to my parents on a regular basis. My mother used to call me know-it-all Carrie. Used to infuriate her. So I really came onto the planet like a warrior for all intents and purposes, a spiritual warrior. And I was very aware of unseen worlds. I am a natural intuitive and was seeing and seeing that reality was not mirroring what I understood to be sort of really out there, but not being manifested. And most people didn't acknowledge. So the awakening, I can't explain it, but I just had that around me since I was really very, very young child. And then I believe that I did have some abduction experiences. I have what you call abduction type dreams, memories, which are the kinds of things which are kind of common out there, which have to do with hearing a buzzing sound. I had a recurring dream in which I was walking out of my house. There was a man standing on the other side of this gate. I would be terrified. He was wearing a long trench coat. Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of thing that I was. So that's kind of an abduction dream.
Definitely. You know, I've had abduction dreams, too, where I was floated aboard a ship. I was given a little kind of hybrid type of creature in my hands. And so I think that did also alter my perceptions that there was something more. I mean, I can't prove that I was abducted. I just have the sense that, yeah, I'm part of that pattern of people that have those types of symptoms there. But you know what did wake me up that something was wrong was in second grade, that when the Kennedy assassination, I was in second grade, and it's like, you know, the word assassinated really stood out. The president was assassinated. And that was like, what does that mean? You know, and it's taken, you know, my whole development to come to terms with that idea that there was another part of the government that could assassinate this part. Do you know, that was an awakening for me. And
absolutely. I do think that the assassination of President Kennedy was an awakening for a lot of people of a certain generation. And for me, it wasn't, but I completely recognize that. I mean, it was a very sorrowful event in my life. And but I have to say, like I said, I was already kind of I was at war with the world when I was a little kid, questioning everything, not accepting sort of the word of so-called authorities or parents. I basically kind of came in with a mission, you might say. So,
But what was the first thing that you heard, like in the media, alternative media? Like, who was the first person that spoke to you about this other view of reality?
Well, other than my own world, so
yeah,
to speak, what I would say, and the other thing is that I read voraciously when I was a child. So I used to just devour books, because what I decided early on was that reality was just not that great. And I was frustrated being a child because I used to think that you know, that I was limited. I didn't get to do anything I wanted and all this kind of stuff. So I was waiting to grow up. And meanwhile, I decided I would read as much as I could. The other thing that happened was, I guess, I remember one of the big awakening kind of experiences, and it sounds a little trite, but was when I saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Oh, no, definitely.
I thought that, oh, my God, other people know about this kind of stuff. Oh, my God, you know, this is like not just in me. You know, it's real. It's out there. That was like a, sort of a real acknowledgement in a big way. And I think that was pretty instrumental. Another thing that happened to me in college is when I took LSD.
Right.
And I think I only took it like once or something. I decided I would experiment and try it because I don't know. I'm a non-addictive personality. I've never had any addictions in my life. I'm not, you know, if I have alcohol, I have one glass of wine. I'm a real, you know, a lightweight in those regards. But anyway, I took LSD and I basically had a conversation with God.
Wow.
And it was very mind expanding, that experience. And basically, there was this incredible sense of love and forgiveness that was coming through. And I remember that very clearly. And the other thing is that I, sometime after that, I decided to meditate. I had been studying about Kundalini and enlightenment. And I decided that was the only thing worthwhile doing on the planet. So I basically set about to reach enlightenment. And I didn't have any teachers or anything. I just decided to do it on my own. And I meditated every day for hours and hours, sometimes through the whole day. And ultimately, in about a month or so, a little over that, I had multiple samadhi experiences. And that, of course, altered that solidified my altered sense of reality. And at one point, I even had the choice. I thought, basically, to leave my body. And I realized that, you know, I had to sort of focus on either being here or leaving. Right. And I decided to stay.
Where did you grow up? Which part of the country were you in?
California. I was a real California girl from, you know, our whole family is like third generation California or something. My great grandfather played cards on the boat with Jack London in San Francisco Bay Harbor. Mm-hmm. So I really was a California kid at Northern California. I was born in Palo Alto and I grew up in Apple, where Apple Computer is now, which when I was growing up was all orchards.
So then in college, when did you start to get into media and develop this use of your awareness to communicate to others?
Well, what I decided was that I wanted to make movies that would enlighten people. That was my goal. And I sort of set out on that trail. And in a funny way, Camelot was almost a side road simply because I got waylaid because I worked in the entertainment business. I came down to Hollywood. First, I went to New York.
Oh,
and
you
I studied
did?
Acting. Oh, yeah. I lived in New York for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I studied acting with Robert X. Modica, who is a Sanford Meisner protege. And I studied in Carnegie Hall, behind Carnegie Hall. And it was a really wonderful experience. And I used to go to acting school every night. And I was also sort of studying directing at the time. And I on the weekends, I was going up to Woodstock and getting involved in a bunch of with music people up there and so on and so forth. It was
this,
an interesting
This was in the 70s or you would say?
Yes.
Okay. Right. All right.
Yes. Well, actually going into the 80s.
Okay. Okay.
Late 70s, 80s. And then what happened was I basically eventually realized I needed to go to film school, and I had graduated. I had gone to college. I went to Sonoma State University, which was a very radical school back when I went there. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's still radical, but I mean, it was exceedingly radical, and I was part of a very unusual group of students that, in fact, one of the things that happened in my class in my sort of program, I was in a special program and they asked us, you know, basically we were getting straight A's and the teacher actually turned to us and said, okay, I'm not allowed to give, I found out I'm not allowed to give everyone an A So is there anyone here that feels that maybe it doesn't matter what their grade is in the future, that, you know, they don't plan to do anything special or whatever? Would they be willing to take a B? And basically I decided, yes, that was me, that I didn't give a shit.
You took the hit for the class.
Yeah. So even though I was doing A. So, yeah. So, but that was great. I mean, I had very radical experiences at Sonoma State University. I met Bobby Seale, I think it was one of the Black Panthers, and he said something that was very instrumental in my life, which was he said to the class that if he influenced one person or reached one person in the entire class, that he's done his job. And I always took that with me wherever I go, like when I speak to people, groups, and so on and so forth. I don't stress out over how many people hear me or understand me or reach me or I reach. Basically, just kind of that became a wonderful model, because I really think that idea of just reaching one person in a group is really a massive idea, just having that as your understanding and you know, goal.
Well, you're reaching millions probably now on the internet with all the Project Camelot YouTubes that are out there, and that must be satisfying. I mean, I know it is for me when people get good feedback about a video, and it's just like, yes, that's why I did it, just for that comment, right? Don't you feel that? Like, just rewarding, even more than money, I feel like. Those transformations of new ideas is why we're doing this. I mean, that's what I feel. And so so from there, from college, you went to film school, and then you when did the whole idea of whistleblowers, and I mean, you were into this, you had an orientation to be radical, but what was the first like interview, and what really changed your mind to open up to this other level that there are whistleblowers?
Let me just say that in college I was a journalist, and I wrote for the school paper, and so I did have my early training as a journalist way back then, and I also rebelled against the paper in certain ways at the time. But if you fast forward to me working in Hollywood for 19 years and then reaching a glass ceiling where I absolutely could not get a movie made or off the ground, in spite of the fact that I had, you know, a lot of training to do so. And I've actually written screenplays, and I was a back pocket client, what they call a back pocket client for at CIA, so used to CIA, no, CAA was Creative Artist Agency, which represented Spielberg and a bunch of other people. Because I did something relatively illegal, I wrote a screenplay adaptation of a Latin American novel called War of the End of the World. And then I wrote to Mario Vargas Llosa, who won a Pulitzer Prize for one of his books, his novels. And he also ran for president of, I can't remember if it's Chile or Peru. It's Peru. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but this has been a long time ago. But at any rate, all of this is background to when I decided to, I reached this glass ceiling. I ended up working in high tech for a number of years. I ended up at JPL, Jet Propulsion Lab. I was writing screenplays at my lunch hour and working in media as a contractor to help them get certain things off the ground with ISO, which was this international sort of measurement standard thing. And I was sort of dealing with media there. So I was doing 3-camera shoots with scientists and engineers. And I was also ended up being kind of like a manager there. And dealing with the scientists and engineers was very interesting. And I guess I had a very good rapport in that way. And I started to investigate, because then what happened was they ran out of money, or the position was actually, I finished my job and then they didn't have any more positions. So I took a lower level job, and I don't remember exactly what it was. It was just a contract job, and I had a tremendous amount of free time. So I used to surf the net, and I began to investigate conspiracies in every way. And I just I went down the rabbit hole, basically. And I always, you know, I was writing all years prior to that, I was writing screenplays, and I wanted to specialize in sci-fi blockbusters. Obviously my influence was Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It was such a mind-bending movie for its time, and I really thought that that was the way to change the world, and I still do, as a matter of fact. In fact, you could say that I'm still on the way there. The next thing I want to do is make more movies.
More narrative pictures with stories and plots and things like that.
Exactly. Because there's a point at which you know, interviewing whistleblowers becomes kind of a dead end, because you can only go so far, because there's only, well, at the moment, they've got a real crackdown in this area. I mean, Camelot came to the fore in 2006, and it was when I had reached this glass ceiling. I was a frustrated filmmaker. I decided my mother had passed on and left me a very small inheritance, and I decided to buy a consumer-grade camcorder and go to UFO conferences and start interviewing the speakers. And I put the camera in front of them, and I basically asked them if they'd seen a UFO. And this was kind of a radical thing to do at the time, because they would go on stage and speak all about, you know, this sector, but they would never say that they personally had seen, you know, had an experience, a lot of these people. Mm-hmm. So I was very successful at that. And basically one of my people that I interviewed was Bill Ryan, who became my partner in Project Camelot.
Right. And he was your partner for a few years, and then he went off and did his own Project Avalon. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes. At a certain point, we kind of worked together for about, I guess, 4 of the 7 years. At the end of that, because I've been on my own now for 3 years doing Camelot, so 7 years altogether. He and I had a parting of the ways towards the last year, very serious differences of opinion on the way things were going and what we thought, you know, at that point we were starting to have differences on who should be interviewed and uh-huh. why. Uh-huh. So we really were going in different directions. I wanted to do radio. He didn't like radio. I mean, there was a lot of weird, you know, and then we had a lot of interference. I'm sure we were taken down in certain respects. We had differences of opinion about certain whistleblowers. Mm-hmm. So it kind of all the shit hit the fan that year. It was really quite radical. And then basically just took over Camelot and kept going since then.
Well, that's the thing about whistleblowers. I mean, there's a lot of disinformation. So someone who comes out as a whistleblower, I'm just thinking as you're saying, you know, I could see how they could be giving you information to lead the public off in a wrong direction. Do you ever come across that with some people or?
Sure. You know, what happens is let me just say this. Yeah. Initially, the way we created Camelot was, first of all, we were inspired by the King Arthur legend of the Round Table.
Oh, it comes from. I get it.
Utopian ideal because Bill Ryan was English. He initially, the way we met and spent time together was after I interviewed him, and the interview I did with him was when he was representing the SERPO project, which was this alien human exchange program that was put out there by the DIA and was a lot of disinfo in it, but he was the webmaster for that. And we hit it off. Eventually he invited me to England and said he would show me the power places. I went there and we went to Tintagel, which is one of the former homes of King Arthur, or said to be.
Yes, I've been there. It's beautiful, overlooking the
it's
sea.
Amazing.
Yeah,
it's spectacular, incredible place. And I had a lot of past life recall of the time of Arthur when I was there. And so we were heavily influenced, I guess you might say, by the Arthurian legend at the time. And right then and there, we created the name and the whole idea of Project Camelot. We both decided to put our skill sets together because both of us wanted disclosure, number one, but we wanted the truth out. We were both sort of truth seekers and had seen beneath the matrix on our own and all that sort of thing. So Bill Ryan was a webmaster and a writer, and I was a filmmaker and a writer. And so it was a very good match of skill sets. And really, we set to work on Camelot without even thinking twice about it. We had no idea we would be, you know, good at it or well known or any of this stuff. We just wanted to do something we wanted to do.
Right.
And I guess the rest, they say, is history.
No, it was a great merging. And then you felt like you had enough skill and you had it together enough to go out on your own when you parted ways and just continue, because this is your passion to go for.
Absolutely.
It.
Well, you know, also the thing is that I was the writer, I was the interviewer and the lead interviewer all the time, most of the time. And I was also the filmmaker, and I taught Bill filmmaking. And, you know, I did all the editing, et cetera, et cetera. And so what happened was, you know, I was doing that prior to Camelot, basically. And then when Bill brought his abilities on the web, it was perfect, because we were able to build websites with, you know, the material we were getting. And then at the same time, you know, he started to take part in the interviews, and eventually it actually got to the point where he wanted to do his own interviews. And that also kind of became a kind of a subtle competition going on there. And we have very different approaches. He's much more low key than I am. But at any rate, it's all good. And yeah, I've continued to do it. The nature of reality that we're in right now is that we're in a spiritual war, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm very concerned that people become awake, learn the truth about the Matrix. I would like to go much more mainstream at this time with Camelot. It's been a very difficult battle, because the powers that be do not want that to happen. And consequently, my Awake and Aware conference is just part and parcel of all of this. This is my third conference of its kind. The first two were highly, highly successful in 2009 and 2011. And so this is now the third one I'm doing. You know, it's a great lineup. It's a huge – Camelot conferences are a lot of fun, because they're unlike any other conference. They're very – there's a lot of unity. The people network and have – you know, the social thing is massive. You'll see, because you're going to be there, and it's going to be fun to have you there too.
Thank you. And there's still tickets available at awakenaware2013.net. You can still purchase tickets for the 3 days, April 5th, 6th, and 7th, 2013. I want to also talk about the nature of the whistleblower. I mean, it's a term that got held over from these – it's a government sort of term that will classify people that coming forward who have these secrets. But the nature of the whistleblowers you interview are of a much deeper level in the awareness of government and black projects and secret government. So talk about what you look for in a whistleblower. How are they brought to your attention?
Well, basically, it is an interesting process. There are a number of ways they come to our attention. Sometimes, very rarely, somebody will be referred to us. Sometimes someone will stumble on our site. The more well-known we got, obviously, the more this type of thing would happen. And they'll write us an email. And what's interesting about that is that most people that write us, we've gotten deluged by people claiming to have, you know, backgrounds or this or that, or, you know, experiences they think are completely unique. And when you get into the sector, these kind of stories kind of become like, oh yeah, right, I've heard that before. But the real whistleblowers are often extremely circumspect. They don't go on for hours and on an email. And a lot of times they even test us to see whether we have integrity, et cetera, et cetera. Because you have to understand, a real whistleblower knows they're risking their life. Somebody who's posing doesn't really get the idea that they might be risking their life.
Well, who was a whistleblower, because now it's out and you can talk about it, that really came forward on Project Camelot and you feel risked their life by talking to you? Name somebody that...
Oh, well, I mean, dozens of them, but Henry Deacon, who's going to be at our conference speaking, will be risking his life doing so. And he's done that for a number of years. He's one person. And I guess Mr. X, this person we call Mr. X, was one of our first whistleblowers ever, and he was actually killed, and we believe he was killed. He died suddenly in very bizarre circumstances for a young man who's barely 40 years old. He suddenly had a heart attack.
Did you do an interview with him?
Of course.
And so you're still calling him Mr. X, even though he was killed.
Yes, actually, this is because of his wife. You know, his wife is still living, and actually, I don't know if she suspects that he was murdered. And he always wanted to protect her. She's a lovely person. He had a newborn baby he was very proud of. It was actually a sad circumstance, and he died very suddenly. He had been deciding to come. He had been out for a number of years. We interviewed him. He was really one of the first people we interviewed. And he became, as the years went on, he got more gutsy, and he thought perhaps it was okay. He could come out under his own name. He was kicking. He had first come out. His whole voice was disguised on our interview. And you can go to Project Camelot and, you know, put in Mr. X and watch the interview. It's a great interview. It was originally mostly with Bill. I did the filming and asked a few questions. This was a person who had contacted Bill directly, so I kind of let Bill take the lead on the interview. And he had been a person who archived footage of basically the U.S. government's interaction with various ET races, and was asked to go into a vault. He worked for Rockwell. I think I can say that name out there now. And it's an aerospace company that basically gave him this job. It was above top secret. He had a guard. He went into a vault every day, and the door was locked behind him, and he was cataloging videotapes and all kinds of memorabilia and papers and so on and so forth, documenting interaction that the government had with the ETs back in the 80s. And he did this for a number of years. Or actually, he did this during the 80s, I guess. And then he was quiet about it for like 20 years or however many years it was between then and now, or then in 2006. And then he came out in our interview with him. Then, as I say, he felt that perhaps it was okay to come out under his own voice. And he was becoming a little more bold, and he was thinking actually of going on Coast to Coast. And we had a conversation about it. He had done a brief audio interview. We spoke at the Crash Retrieval Conference in November of that year, which has been a couple years since he died now. Might have been 3 years since he died, maybe four. Anyway, and then about less than a month later, it was getting near Christmas, and he was going Christmas shopping with his wife. He complained of not feeling well, and then in the middle of the night, he woke up and he felt terrible. His wife took him to the hospital, and he was dead by 12 noon that day. So we actually feel that he was taken out.
So, I mean, what do you think he said? Was it just the fact that he revealed that he was working with this footage of alien government documents and films that did him in, if you were going to hypothesize about what could have taken him out or why? Or what did he say? Something that was really key in, you know, revealing these government secrets. I mean,
well, it's a good question. You know, I don't know why they took him out. It seems, you know, from my perspective, even especially now, when they're actually in some ways they're kind of trying to force disclosure in a weird way right now. We could talk more about that, but
oh, I do want to talk about that because I'm just writing a paper. But yeah, what about this?
Yeah, but basically, because he said there were the tall oranges, that we had done deals, you know, government contracts with the Greys, that we'd been interacting with them. I mean, there was validation of the whole Eisenhower Maroc Air Force Base interaction. There were various things going on in his testimony. It's all on Camelot. But to pinpoint what exactly angered them, to be honest, I don't know. I think maybe, you see, again, he was allowed to continue, and for a number of years. It was only when he started to kind of think that he could become, I guess, go out and be more bold when he was, as I'm saying, as he was thinking about possibly going on coast to coast, possibly coming out under his own name, this kind of thing is when he was taken out. So perhaps as long as he was obscure in that situation, they decided that, you know, he was becoming too, you know, they basically, maybe they thought he was, had remained obscure enough, even though we did an interview with him, that there wouldn't be any notice in the mainstream. See, you got to understand, their issue is never so much with the alternative media finding out stuff, because they consider us to be majorly fringe. And so they don't care whether we know this or we know that for the most part. What they care is if there are leaks to the outside mainstream that the mainstream would have a tendency to take seriously. And most of the time, they don't take us seriously at all.
And they don't even take Coast to Coast seriously, which is probably the biggest outlet for.
Sure.
But I do want to talk about this pushing disclosure, because I'm writing a piece now about the FBI memo, the Guy Hudl memo. Do you know about that?
Yes.
That just came out in the news, because the FBI says, wow, this is our most looked at memo out of all the thousands of files they have on this website called The Vault. And there, in one interview, the FBI was complaining that people weren't looking more at their crime fighting memos, and they were looking at this UFO memo, and they're also drawing attention to it. So they're saying two things at the same time. They say, people are looking at that. Why are they looking at it? And this is what they're looking at it. So they're, it's a kind of very tricky way of mind manipulation, I think, to say, don't pay attention to that, but also pay attention to that. Do you know where I'm going? You know what I'm saying about that?
Well, sure. You know, all I have to say about that memo, for example, is, you know, that when they want to have disclosure, they always trot out these old, you know, things like Roswell. I mean, it's just like so typical for them to trot this out as though it's, you know, it's just being discovered. I mean, it just annoys the hell out of me. But it is true that the mainstream will take this as though it's actually news. And they are looking for ways to bridge the gap right now, because they have a lot of disclosures they want to make. They are going to, the world is going to change, and it's changing around everyone. And the people that are completely in the dark in the mainstream, that just don't have a clue whatsoever, you know, they can't really deal with these people losing it mentally completely. So they need to have some kind of slow immersion into the truth.
Right. No, and, I think you're right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, without being lynched. You know, which without being lynched on the White House lawn, when these people find out how much they've been lied to. So it's really Camelot, people like Camelot, and I assume your show and others like us, are basically doing them a service. We are helping to break the ice. We're helping to bring all this to the fore. And so in a certain sense, they're allowing more of us to do just that. The trouble is that in some ways the alternative media kind of shoots itself in the foot half the time with nonsense and with backbiting and all kinds of craziness. But yeah, the train is moving forward.
Well, that was the thing, though, about this particular memo. It was on the top 10 news stories on Yahoo. That's where I first saw it. And then the FBI is saying that millions of people have now looked at this document. And I talked to Grant Cameron, or I emailed him about that. And he says, you know, if the government wanted the UFO story to go away, they'd stop paying attention to it. So this kind of slow disclosure is about what you're saying. It's preparing people, the mainstream public, so they don't freak out when it comes out that, hey, we have company. You know, it's going to come out. It's at some point in our near history, future history, it's going to be revealed that, you know, and it's obvious that this is not the only place in the universe that has life. But, you know, and of course, the government has been aware of that for a long time. So this slow, soft disclosure is what I think we're preparing ourselves for. And of course, your program and what my program, it's for people who want to go deeper into that. But just on the superficial level, people start to think, hey, well, if the FBI is into this in their files, it plants a seed of possibility. And I think that's what slow disclosure is all about, because I don't think people can take, you know, Obama coming out and saying, guess what, we have company. So I think it's a, I think it's about a 50 to 100 year process ultimately, but it might be quicker than that. I mean, you're thinking it's going to happen really soon, huh?
Well, I think you have to qualify your terms. In essence, I mean, I think that what is happening here is that the government is not going to come out on the White House lawn and say, hey, everyone, we lied to you. By the way, they're here. I don't think that that's going to happen. Although, look, if worse comes to worse and they have to do that, they'll do it. But I think that what they're going to, their preference is at this time is they realize that they kept the lid on for too long and that there's a huge gap in the way the secret government is living and the interactions they're having with these various races, and that the war of the world, so to speak, is coming home to roost, as it has been, but it's getting harder and harder to hide it. And this is part of the problem they're having. We're also getting into an area of space, and we've also sort of entered the galactic community as a race of beings. And so that we have to, we're sort of on the neighborhood now. And that means that we're, you know, all whole sort of, people used to say there was kind of a I don't know what you call it. It basically, we were off limits for off world races. They were supposed to stay away, et cetera. I never bought into that, but I can tell you that if ever there was a time when we are back, we are now on the radar of these other races, and it's basically a free for all. We have entered the free for all. We are now moving into the fourth dimension, and we are much more in the fourth density, and we are much more in that world that is inhabited by all the different beings of various densities. And the fourth density is known for the occupation of that density by grays and other beings that are like that. So we have to contend with these beings. It's what being in the sector is all about.
Right.
So it's coming whether they like it or not. So they're going to, of course, they're going to try to spin it. You can appreciate that, right?
Oh, totally. And when I do my lectures on what is new realities, I talk about this fourth dimensional vibration that actually we're moving into, where we're less dense, I feel, than we were 50 or 100 years ago. And also, I think the 2012 myth, that whole story behind it, was really about reorientating ourselves to a new neighborhood, that we are now no longer solar, but we're galactic in our awareness. So therefore, we're meeting a much broader landscape, a much larger environment of beings and consciousness that are coming our way. And, you know, we're just moving into a new space and being exposed to new cosmic radiations that are also activating different neural net circuits in our brain to wake up to the higher potentials that we all hold. So that's where I come at it from. Does that make sense?
Sure. Oh, well, yeah, absolutely. And I would agree with you. I do think that 2012 was, from what I understand, the very end of 2012 was the taking down of what is called a frequency fence that was all about a programming humanity to sort of stay asleep, that the fence has been removed at this point. And if people just sort of stretch their consciousness even a little, they will begin to feel that the limits or the limitations have been taken away, and that the sky's the limit and beyond, really, for creativity, for building a world that you would like to see. And by the same token, on the sort of darker side of that, then it's also open season for all different kinds of beings to come here and try to influence our path and our direction. And so this is where, you know, people have to, they basically have to wake up or face being sort of taken over.
Or being shocked when the wake up happens. You know, I mean, you can hide in a little hole and ignore all this stuff and be totally blown away by a reality that's incomprehensible if you're not slowly getting the cues that something else is happening here.
Right. But, you know, there's also a sort of a learning by osmosis that does happen in humanity. So, and many of these beings, of course, we're all multidimensional, will on some dimensional level, even if they're completely in the dark in their earth bodies, will have a sense, their higher soul will certainly know the game is much broader than they understand it in their, as I say, their earth body. So what's interesting is, and I think this is going to be the case, is that more and more people will get up to speed quicker. So let's say people on a learning curve maybe took, 5 years to really learn what the ET presence is and so on and so forth. But as time sort of accelerates and people on a learning curve, you could call it the 100th monkey syndrome, but it's more than that. It really is a consciousness leap that has the ability of, if some part of humanity's consciousness is conscious, which it is, then by osmosis, the other parts of it will learn quicker and get up to speed faster. And that, yes. I think that's what we're going to see. So
I think you're absolutely right about that. And I think, yeah. I think the slow disclosure, I just want to read, have you read the Guy Hudl memo lately and what it says?
No.
All right. Well, it's just so amazing. I didn't actually read it until I saw this on Yahoo. And March 22nd, 1950, it says in the FBI files, the vault, three so-called flying saucers have been discovered in New Mexico. They were described as being circular in shape with raised centers approximately 50 feet in diameter. Each one was occupied by three bodies of human shape but only 3 feet tall, dressed in metallic cloth of a very fine texture. Each body was bandaged in a manner similar to the blackout suits used by speed flyers and test pilots. The FBI then goes on and say there's no further investigation on their part was taken in the matter. But that is very explicit and very detailed to have in their records. And anyone can go to the vault, the FBI online file, and read that for themselves. And I think that's just a fantastic piece of disclosure right there. I mean,
okay, well, I mean, that's fair enough. I did read that. Yeah. You know, it just kind of blows by me because it's so,
yeah, it's so
sort of, oh, God, this is really so old school. But
it is.
I get it. I appreciate it. And I see that, you know, that will have meaning for some people out there that really they need to know that this kind of stuff is real. And they want, you know, they want proof and they want hard proof. And they believe, you know, they believe the FBI, but they're not going to believe a whistleblower. So what can I tell you? It's great. You know,
well, whatever. That's what I mean. For that level of population who has no idea suddenly to see something like this on FBI, there's a seed that's planted that then if they want to look further, they can go to what we're doing and other resources. But tell me then, what was the thing that really did blow you away? What was the revelation that you heard in an interview or somewhere? It's like, oh, my God. This is a new take on reality. Was there anything or have you heard it all?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, I never stood there with my mouth open. In the whole time of Camelot, I'm going to be honest with you.
Okay.
I mean, I never did. What can I tell you? But I had, even coming into this life, I had a huge imagination. And so to my way of thinking, anything man could imagine could happen. Even to this day, you know, one of the things that kind of works for me in Camelot that is that I'm pretty non-judgmental. In other words, if somebody writes to me and has the most outlandish story known to man, I don't throw it out of court. What I do is analyze it, and what I do is compare and contrast it. And what we've always done with Camelot is to take anything and look for three unrelated sources that will come to us from completely different places with the same pieces of information. And at that point, we really have to take whatever it is seriously. And that's basically what an intelligence officer in an agency does anyway. Now, on top of that, what I use is my intuition, which has served me extremely well in Camelot, I have to say. And so I tend to rely on it very, very heavily at this time.
Well, that's about moving into this next dimension. I think we have to then trust this awakening of the next level of consciousness to sort of be our guide, especially as things sort of fall apart on the outside. And I think so that's a really good piece. I think that I would even love for you to bring that out more, your sense of intuition. You know.
Oh, well, thank you. I do appreciate that. Well, actually, I mean, you know, I do. I mean, it's just a constant part of me. So I'm always, it depends if people are paying attention to my blog. And I have to say that my blog is the key place now where Camelot releases true information that's coming out. And I use my intuition every day on those articles in bringing forward certain things and not others. It's all about discernment. And so I will, you know, I'm careful because on the one hand, I do sort of rely on the journalistic principles of not sort of trying to tell a person what to think. Mm-hmm. I have a certain balance that allows me to also stand back and say, well, this is what I'm being told. And then at a certain point in the article or whatever I write, I will sometimes say, you know, it seems to me, or I'll sort of couch it with certain qualifying statements or sarcasm or whatever I use to color certain things a certain way. But basically, I like people to do their own research. I like them to reach their own conclusions. I really don't care. I'm not interested in people following me like some guru. I am actually very anti any guru type personalities or people that tend to think of themselves in that way. I just see them as Illuminati types. You know, it's a power play. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really interested in going there. So yeah, I mean, I do use my intuition and I talk about it a lot when I do interviews. But, you know, most interviews, you can appreciate this, are not with me. I'm doing interviews with other people, and I'm allowing them to tell their story. So it's not really about what I think.
Right. And I understand that. And I think that's why I do it too. I mean, I'm fascinated by people's stories. And if I can share what I'm hearing and other people can change or have a seed of a new idea planted in their reality, then I feel I've definitely done my job. So this whole idea of time travel, which is one of the most exciting subjects that I've can think of, will be the subject of this upcoming Awake and Aware event happening April 5th, 6th, and 7th in Glendale, California. You can get tickets at awakeandaware2013.net. But it's a subject of this particular subject is, I think, key in understanding this next level of reality, what you call the fourth dimension, this fourth frequency of vibration we're moving into, because time is no longer what it used to be. There seems like there's a different movement within the frequency and density of this earth field. And I hope these speakers, and I'm sure they will be talking about this understanding of this fluidity and this shift in the way we relate to time. I mean, what's interesting for you about this subject of time travel?
Well, part of the reason I wanted to do something on time travel is because it's become more and more, as I've done research into this sector and as the years go on, it seems to have become sort of the cornerstone, in a certain sense, of understanding the secret space program and what's really going on here on the planet. And it really branches into the multidimensional nature of reality and ourselves. And so this is where I was interested in taking people, and time travel is in a certain sense, or that word, the wording, is kind of like a door in to that, to starting to consider those aspects and understanding that you have multiple selves that are in simultaneous incarnation, et cetera, et cetera. And And so that was my interest in focusing on time travel. The other thing is that I have a sense that it is, you know, certain things are reach their time in the zeitgeist of consciousness on the planet. And I think time travel is coming into its own right now. And people are starting to realize there's more to it. It's not just a quirky sci-fi, idea.
Well, it doesn't. Well, a lot of these subjects do start in sci-fi to plant a seed of reality, and of course, it has an intuition of possibilities. So I think, some people might still consider it sci-fi, but once they hear some of the speakers at this conference, they'll realize there's actually a technology that involves quantum physics and the understanding of that. Non-local realities are very much a part of what the new science is all about, and people have been able to build technologies around this new understanding. Of course, it's a shift in our worldview and the ideas of who we are as multidimensional beings, but just also it's a shift in the nature of reality. That's why I'm so excited, because I know it's true. I mean, when quantum physicists say they can send an atom or electron back in time, and they do that, then it's like where's that ending? That it doesn't. It starts with the electron, but it doesn't end there. And I think as we build this new culture and this new awakening, these types of scientific projects and activities will become more public. And more talked about. And I think this is the first of that. So in a way, it's a historic conference on that level.
Well, I think it definitely is historic. I don't think anything like this has even been attempted in the past. And I have to say that the obstacles we've encountered on the way to getting this conference into reality have been substantial, as you will know, Alan.
Right.
So with that in mind, I mean, obviously the powers that be, however you want to characterize them, didn't want to see this thing happen. And they really did work in many ways to short circuit us or take us off track. But I was determined to sort of stay the course. And now I have a whole group of volunteers that are working behind the scenes to make this a reality and doing a wonderful job. And Tommy Hansen, our webmaster, who's a consultant at this time to Camelot, is front and center in that group of people, as well as my event coordinator, whose name I'm not going to say in public, and a number of people whose names I will also not. You know, what happens with Camelot is that people want to help us, and they're dedicated to help us, but sometimes they become targets by the powers that be after that. So I want to protect them. I'd love to be able to give them credit in a much more upfront way. But if you come to the conference, you can thank them in person. And I just have to say it's going to be it is a historic event, and it is worth being there in person. We will be live streaming it.
Oh, yeah.
So you can live stream. And all of that is available on the Awake and Aware 2013.net website, and you can advance purchase the live stream. So, that will be, it's actually extremely reasonable, and it's also very reasonable for the weekend. I have to say it works out to be something like $20 a speaker or less.
I see.
It's so crazy. It's so reasonable, but we really wanted to keep in mind that the state of the economy, and people are having a hard time swinging the prices of conferences lately, so I'm sympathetic to that.
Oh, there's been lots of conferences that have been planned and canceled just this past year because of expenses or for whatever reason. But I'm really glad this is happening, that you've been dedicated to to going for it and to going forward with this, because I think this will then mark a new phase of our history, in a sense, as this kind of information comes out. I mean, it sort of reminds me of this conversation I had with Hal Puthoff, where he says, I asked him about teleportation, And he says, well, he hasn't seen teleportation, but they can teleport the properties of things from one place to another. And so there was like a slight, I think, leak of what is possible in science and the technologies behind it. And but let's talk just briefly about some of the people who will be highlighting this conference. We talked about Bashar, who, if you don't know, is an extraterrestrial, so he says, from the future, who is an offspring of the abduction program. I mean, his genetics and his lineage goes back to the time in our history now when people were being genetically taken to create this next race. And Bashar talks from a sort of enlightened place where that has already happened. I mean, what do you think of Bashar and his and what he has to say with this unfolding of time travel and the realities? It's a whole nother aspect. I mean, it's not quite in the whistleblower camp, but I think it's an important piece.
Absolutely. I just want to say right now that I don't think I'm hallucinating, but it looks like our awake and aware, this is the kind of thing that goes on, believe me, with Camelot. It's just bizarre. And I have to say, it sort of blows my mind every time. They've taken down our awakened aware website.
I was looking at that. At least they're listening to the program, but I was right. Looking for it too. I was looking for awakened.
It's just incredible. It is just incredible. Obviously, whatever I'm saying, they're not happy about, and they're losing their fucking minds over it. So this is how they like to punish us, to let us know that they're out there and they wield the big stick. What jerks. I mean, you know, please. This is the question. Is the people that come and versus the live stream, let me say this, the people that are there in person will see the real thing. Whether or not we get this out over the air at the time that it happens, God knows, because we will have everything going for us. We will work very hard in that regard. But this kind of stuff goes on. Electronic interference is just massive. And do you happen to have a commercial or a break of any kind? Because I do not have to call my webmaster.
No, call your website and I'll just go to a little break, but I'll tell people that, you know, I was looking for it. And I say, you know, sometimes, and it's like it just comes up that the connection is not happening for this website. And it's the awake.
Yeah.
So go ahead. How long are you going to be? Because
It'll just, you know, 5 minutes or less. Less.
All right.
Than 5 minutes.
Okay. I'll just do a little talking here about.
Thank you.
Because I was actually looking for the speakers that are going to be there. The list of speakers that are coming to this Awaken Aware show 2013.net, and as Carrie just said, that whole website has been taken down for some reason. And it makes me sort of happy to know that the government is tuning into this program, although it's not very nice to take down someone's website just before a conference is coming up like this. But just for me to go over the list of speakers that will be there, who I think are really top-notch speakers, will be David Wilcox, hasn't been a guest on this show, but he's very out there and sort of talking about an alternative reality, and it's reality based on a spiritual vibrational perspective. Also Richard C. Hoagland, who's always on Coast to Coast and head of the Mars Project, as far as the investigation into what's really happening on Mars. Okay, so I was just going over some of the list of speakers here. Now, who's George Green? Because I was going to read it off the website. That's not there anymore.
I did reach my webmaster just then, so he's on the job. Incredible. George Green he's a whistleblower, and he comes from the financial side of the story, so to speak, which is kind of unusual. He's not necessarily on point in terms of the time travel theme, except in the fact that he did have a lot of exposure and dealings with Billy Meyer and the Pleiadians.
Oh.
And so that was early on. But basically he was a, well, I don't even know what you would call him, but he ended up building, he was asked to build a FEMA camp at one point in Nevada. He was a heavy, you know, he was heavily invested in real estate. He was into the banking sector, and they tapped him to be, I guess, finance chairman or something like that. They were planning to bring him on board the government back in the days of, I think it was Carter or Johnson, one of those. Anyway, he had sort of an awakening experience because I guess it was Edward Kennedy, I think it was an Edward Kennedy story in which he basically made some lewd comments about a woman in the room who happened to be George Green's daughter. When George realized sort of the designs and the attitude this man had towards his daughter and, you know, a lot of the dreadful things that were going on behind the scenes, I guess it just really woke him up. And so he kind of went on to the side of the light. And since then, he's been working really nonstop to waken people as to the financial situation, as to things that are coming down the pike. And he's very knowledgeable. He's helped governments such as Ecuador and other governments try to get their money onto a gold standard, or, you know, get out from under the, I guess, the heel of the United States, the Fed, whatever you want to call it, and so on. And so he will be there. Yeah, he's a fascinating guy. He's also written these wonderful books, which he didn't write. He kind of took his dictation, he calls it, from what he says are the Pleiadians. And the message in there is quite wonderful. So I do recommend him. He was quite a wealthy man, and he puts them on his website and releases them all for free.
So he's an economic insider who's really connected, yes, to ETs. That's a really good combination we need in our camp there, you know. It's like,
sure.
I was just commenting while you were gone that it's like, I can't believe there's the government, whoever is part of it, actually listening to this radio show and taking, I mean, I'm like shocked. Really? It's like, are people... Are they, yes, listening to that? I mean,
just incredible. And it looks like our site just came back up. This is the kind of thing that goes on that, in fact, last week, about a week ago, for 4 days, they attacked Camelot nonstop in such a brutal fashion in terms of hacking electronics that we basically had to rebuild our entire website. So people, it looks the same to people, but believe me, the amount of work that's gone into dealing with these attacks has been stupendous. And, you know, Tommy does a lot of this work. I pay him very, very little to do it. He will be live streaming the conference. He will be on at the site on the doing the conference, helping with a team of filmmakers, getting this out to the world, documenting it, recording it. So,
well,
yeah.
Well, I just want to tell people the Awaken Aware 2013.net website is back up. You can order tickets there.
That's incredible.
The other person, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, of course, everyone knows David Wilcox, and we talked about Bashar, and Sean David Martin's an old friend of mine, and Preston Nichols, who's really the guy behind the Montauk experiment. He's really, I think, the first that came out and said there was a connection between the Philadelphia experiment and the Montauk experiment. There was this time loop that happened, and people appeared in Montauk at Fort, what is that place out there? Is it Fort Hope there? Out in Montauk, there's a very strange antenna that's still part of that Montauk project, and you can go out there and look at it. And Preston in the early 80s went out there and dug up equipment, and he really broke that whole story. I mean, have you met Preston at all?
I'm going to be meeting him when he's here at the conference, but I have interviewed him on my radio show, and you know, I read all the Montauk books, and that's how I got connected with Peter Moon. This is actually before Camelot. I was investigating the Montauk project and fascinated by all of that. And the time travel aspects of the Montauk you know, the whole Montauk Project and Philadelphia Experiment, the link between them. Very, very interesting things going on behind the scenes. David Wilcock also has a whistleblower who basically came forward to him, and he will probably be talking a lot about his material. He calls him Daniel. I was hoping that Daniel himself would come. He's not an unknown person, actually. He's got a website and everything. But I forget his name offhand, but at any rate, he is a scientist or whatever. And he has come forward in regard to the Montauk Project as well and all the different aspects. But I mean, this lineup is really stellar, I have to say. Stephen Kelly is someone who's brought forward the base underneath the Getty Museum, which is a fascinating story. And he's also heavily worked, you know, been involved in the occult, I would say, but he's a laser scientist. And his specialty is lasers. And it's because of his abilities in the area of laser technology that he has learned all the things about the secret government that he knows. And so he's a fabulous speaker and a great addition to our lineup here. Richard C. Hoagland, of course, everyone knows, but Richard will be coming forward with stuff about time travel. He's never really talked about time travel. In fact, he was a late addition to the conference simply because I didn't know he had any background in that area.
That sounds exciting because I do think he's a very brilliant mind, and he also understood the coordinates of that. Was it 45 degree angles inside a sphere that creates these topological energetic features on
19,
the planet? 19.5, yes.
Yeah, that whole, yeah, and there's a huge amount of validity to what he says. And he's going to be releasing some key information that's never been released before. So this is very exciting. Anthony Sanchez.
Yeah, who is Anthony Sanchez? Because I haven't heard of him.
No, he wrote a book called The UFO Highway, and he interviewed – the whole book is basically an interview with a whistleblower called The Colonel. It's all about Dulce and sort of the interaction with Greys that our secret government has had. And goes over that secret past. There is, I believe, some disinfo in there. For the most part, it's good solid information. Since then, though, Anthony has really gone down the rabbit hole, and he's written a new book. He's not released it. He's had death threats like you can't believe. Even I was called by a certain person and told to deliver a message to Anthony. The key with Anthony is to understand that he is a software developer and had his own software company. He also worked for some of the top software companies in Silicon Valley. And so his background in evaluating technology is superior to just your average UFO investigator, so to speak.
You know, the first time
makes him a real double-edged threat to the powers that be.
No, I think that's great that he's there. I mean, I was just going to say the first time I ever heard about Dulce was William Cooper, who I think was really the prime whistleblower of his time. I mean, There Comes a Pale Horse. I mean, that was, for me, the thing that broke the whole field open. Did you ever meet William Cooper?
No, I didn't. He was before my time, but I would have loved to. He's one of my heroes.
Yeah.
I think he and Phil Schneider are really the two guys that come to mind as really being sort of the giants in this whole field.
And of course the government did kill him. I don't care what people say.
Right.
I think the government went and took him out.
No doubt about it. Yeah. No doubt about it. I mean, you know, it's very interesting how this whole thing plays out over time. And of course, if ever the true history of this whole sector gets to be revealed, I mean, these will be, I have to say, this lineup is we really have the movers and shakers in this whole area. Very carefully chosen people to bring out this sort of new twist involving time travel. I mean, Sean David Morton's book was completely given to him basically by a whistleblower. So whistleblower testimony is a very strong backbone to the conference and to the realizations that are going to come out about time travel. What was unique about the situation with Sean is that that particular whistleblower died, and his lawyer contacted Sean, told him that the author wanted Sean to release his information, but that his family was still alive, and he asked that he do it as a fictional book. So he wrote Sands of Time. It's a wonderful book, highly recommended. It's actually basically a non-fiction book couched as fiction. It's telling you the history of Area 51, of the development of the secret space program, and this guy was the head of Area 51, believe it or not. He also led a raid into Dulce at a certain point. And the whole time he is visited by a time traveler. And this particular time traveler is a Nazi from Project Paperclip, who then comes back and reveals certain technical information to him, and so on and so forth. So it's a fascinating story. I have been contacted by a very special time traveler person, or a person who has experience with this. I am going to be releasing some information at the conference. I had hoped that this key new person would be coming forward on their own. They're actually not going to come forward. So I was sort of couching them as a mystery guest. Although maybe I'll be surprised and they'll show up. That would be awesome. But their story is absolutely gangbusters. And there's a lot to be revealed in this whole time travel aspect. There's the physics of it, which Richard Hoagland will be covering some of the physics. Certainly, I'm sure David Wilcock will touch on some of the physics. And then there's the other sides of it, which play out in reality that have to do with, Preston Nichols may touch on physics, but certainly the experiences that he's had directly with this. I know Bashar will come from a whole different angle. It's really going to be a great way to approach the subject, because we're coming at it with all these different threads that then meet in the middle, and time travel is what unites them all.
Right. And I think a perspective that I can add or lend is the idea that it takes a shift in consciousness to actually realize that we are these time travel beings, you know, that we exist in a sense beyond time in the consciousness of our minds, in your states of samadhi that you went into when you were meditating those years growing up. There was a transcendence of the linear time as we know it, and to reframe time in a new way, I think, is what we need to do now in order to shift the realities that are emerging. And so that's why I think just having these people come forward and talking about different possibilities will plant seeds, and people listening, being there, hearing it on the stream. And I think there's new possibilities for the human race to explore that we have yet to embrace, and that's what's exciting about it for me.
Absolutely, it's thrilling, and it is important, because you know you can see how this can trickle down to a wider understanding of what it means to be human, and that can trickle down to understanding things like peace and war. Understanding other kinds of beings, other racial groups, beyond earthly racial even, and so on, and begin to start a sort of having a wider view of what it really means to be human, or to be a spirit having a material existence such as it is as a human being, and all the possibilities, and how expansive that really becomes when you take this all on board. So, I mean, I think it's going to be a mind-expanding experience just to be there. And it always is. Camelot, there's a magic at Camelot conferences that just surpasses. People come up to me and tell me this all the time. So it's not just me. I'm not just prejudiced. They tell me all the time that there's just they really, for weeks afterwards, they're just in some kind of euphoria, having connected with people of like mind who realize that the potential that we have.
Right. And I'm happy you're doing this. And just for people to know that reality is not what we've been told and conditioned to think it is. And And this is the fight, in a way, to free our minds from the conditioning of an imposed reality and to see who we really are as human beings. I think that's why it's important that this information comes forward. So thank you, Carrie, for all the work.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I appreciate you having me on the show here. And, I'm very happy to share whatever it is I can share to, you know, with your listeners.
Right. Looking into the future, is there anything that, I know you said you want to do some movies, but what excites you next? What's on the horizon coming your way?
Well, let's see. I'm basically, things are pretty open. I'm actually thinking of leading another trip. I did take a group of people to Egypt during 2012 for that whole period of time, which was an incredible, incredible experience. I have to say, and there were about 15 people. It was a very small group, but we really got entree into all kinds of places in Egypt, temples, and did a lot of meditations, had a lot of very mind expanding experiences, and really amazing. So I am thinking of taking another group. I have a particular interest in tracking down the role of the Anunnaki on the planet, and I'm still on that trail. So I've been getting more and more information along those lines. I think that there's a central sort of an operations center in Israel, for example, underground.
Some people say that's why we went into Iraq, is to find out some of the Stargate Anunnaki underground bases that might still be there. I don't know if I believe that or not, but
Absolutely. You know, I do. This is absolutely in keeping with what is. I mean, there are a number of Stargates or portals around the planet, and they are heavily guarded and heavily contested by various groups. And including the U.S. military, by the way, and one of which is in Giza, and so on, in the Great Pyramid, and so on. But so you asked me what I'm doing in the future. I'm hoping to take another group. This time we'll go to Petra in Jordan.
I love Petra. That is a fantastic.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Have you been there?
Yes, I have.
Oh, incredible.
I've been to the Middle East. Is sort of like a love place, a really place that I adore. I love Africa and the Middle East. For some reason, these are very, very sort of high in my list of places to be. And I like to go back as often as I can. So I will
feel like home there. I mean, not the politics, but the land itself to me.
Yes, very much so. It just resonates with me incredibly. Yeah. And the people. I love the Arab people. I love the Israeli people as well. I mean, I have to say that there's something about that world, that part of the world. I love Africa. I mean, it's just, I don't know how to explain it. It goes beyond this. It's sort of like beyond the skin level where it's just a feeling. It's very evocative of, perhaps it's a racial memory. You know, people say that. It's in our genes.
You know where I think you might love to take a Project Camelot group to is the crop circles in England in Wiltshire. I led two trips there, and they were amazing being in those circles.
And, oh, really? Uh-huh.
And knowing that they are real communications from another level of existence.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, there's no doubt whatsoever, as far as I'm concerned, that the pyramids and various structures in Egypt are also, we're talking about the signs of Atlantis. We're talking about the Anunnaki, the traces of the Anunnaki. This is what I'm sort of on the trail of. So going to Petra in Jordan, going to various places in Jordan. I mean, I also want to go at some point to Zeptepi. And I'd like to, I wanted to go to the Greek islands. I'm very interested in all of that. So, you know, where we're talking about the Delphi, oracle and so on. It's just because when I go to these places, I basically time travel back to those times. I get triggered by places, and it's quite a fascinating experience, for me personally, and I think others as well. And so I don't know how it's going to all play out. I've been so focused on this particular conference, I haven't had time to think about my life beyond it.
Well, do you know an interesting fact is that the Great Pyramid was covered with white alabaster stone, and there was an earthquake, and a lot of the outer casing fell off. And then they built the Mosque of Ali in Cairo with a lot of the stones that fell off the pyramid there. And there's, you can still see a sort of alien writing in the Mosque of Ali that was supposedly on the outside of the Great Pyramid. So
that's, yes,
that is worth a trip.
Wonderful. Absolutely, yeah. Wonderful. Yeah, fascinating as well. The whole area is just absolutely fascinating. We went out to what's called the White and the Black Desert. Just amazing, amazing moon-like place. Otherworldly, completely otherworldly. You know, I just feel very fortunate to have been able to take a group of people out to these places. And I think that they really valued this. I was, you know, to, as lifelong experiences to be cherished. So this is something worth doing. You know what I mean?
Well, do you know Abydos is a big ET portal? I mean, that's what some people say.
Yes. And I, there's no doubt in my mind.
Right.
It is. It's heavy. It's wonderful. So you've obviously been to these places.
Yeah,
as well, right?
I love Petra. I think Jerusalem has very strange high energy for some reason. Oh, and the Cave of Hebron. I had quite a mystical experience where I felt like I was falling out of my body. It was actually having a waking out of body experience, looking into what they call the Cave of the Patriarchs in Israel. In this, now it's a very heavily guarded city, but it's called the Cave of Hebron, and it was an amazing time for me. And sitting in the sarcophagus, or laying down in the sarcophagus in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, was another revelation, another level of my own awakening happened there. So, yeah, I think people should go to these places, experience it, and like you said, sort of time travel back to their multidimensional selves. I think those are the doorways that are available to us in some of these sacred places.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I mean, I say to people that going to power, I call them power places. Yeah. A lot of these places have tremendous energy. You literally can feel it. I feel energy in my hands, so I can tell when I'm in a vortex or whatever kind of place. But even for people that don't necessarily feel those kinds of energies so naturally, they will be affected, and it will change, you know, it changes your life. It changes your dreams, changes you energetically. There's just so much benefit from actually traveling around the planet and experiencing these things. So yeah, that's something I hope to do this year, more of this year, once I get this conference sort of under my belt. But
well, it's coming up. It'll be there this Friday.
Yeah, it is, and actually, we'll be seeing you in person there, Alan. It'll be a lot of fun, and you'll come on stage with me and be introducing people and all of that, and it's just going to be a lot of fun. The Meet the Speaker party on Friday night is a great thing, and we're going to do kind of a fun thing that night, and you'll probably be able to join in with us. We're going to do kind of a red carpet, like Academy Awards, where you go around with the mic and you interview people and sort of on the spot and during the party.
Oh, I'd love to do that. Sure.
Yeah, it's going to be so fun. So Anthony Sanchez and I are going to do that. And you'll probably join us. You'll be one of the people we certainly come bring on the air at any rate. And so
well,
it's
if you
just
want to do some of the on the red carpet interviews, that would be
sure. Fun. We can, you know, we'll trade the mic. We're going to have mics on the floor, and it, you know, all things going as planned. This is the type of thing we're just going to have fun with it. So
what time is that Friday night?
Well, the party starts at 6 p.m. I mean, it really goes from 6 till 12 midnight. But you know, people will sort of straggle in from 6 to 7, I would say. And then probably doesn't launch itself until 7 really.
Okay, great. And you're going to be streaming that party. That's part of the red carpet.
Well, this will be over radio. We're not going to live stream the party per se, because that takes a whole setup.
Right.
Although they may try to do some things, experimental things. Because we're in a different location. What happens is we rent the conference room, and you know, they have a huge setup to live stream that.
I see, yeah.
And that's upstairs. But the party is in a bar. you know, and actually the general public can come. The party itself is free.
Oh.
We sort of decided to make it free.
Okay.
So, you know, anyone really can come to the party, and not even we're going to be selling tickets to the following, you know, to the next 2 days at the party. So you can also buy your ticket there. But, we just decided to open it up to the public, just make it a great, you know, sort of party fun atmosphere without any financial thing going on, other than people will obviously be buying drinks at the bar. I mean, the hotel will be more than happy with our patronage, I guess you call it.
Great. So the hotel, the bar's right in the hotel there?
Yes.
It's in the in Glendale Embassy Suites is where that's right. going to be. And that's where the conference is going to be.
That's where everything is. That's where the people, you know, will be staying overnight there. I mean, people flying in from outside the country or outside the city will obviously be staying there. Anyone who wants to. And there's actually across the street, there's another hotel. I think it's the Hilton hotel. So, there's plenty of room to get a room if you decide to stay. The nice thing of having everything all in one place, I mean, it costs me more money, but it's worth it because it means that people don't have to go and come and worry about, you know, drinking, driving, all that kind of nonsense. If you come and you get a hotel room, you're just there. Mm-hmm. And people stay up until like 3 and 4 in the morning just chatting with each other because it's just such a unique experience to be able to share these wonderful individuals, to share thoughts with them, to meet other people that are visitors who are there. I mean, we'll have people in the audience that are equally qualified in various ways and worth talking to. So, and there will probably be a few, there'll be the usual suspects, what I call them.
Undercover, you mean?
Oh, intelligence agents and all of these people. I mean, we'll probably have more per capita intelligence agents buying tickets than than any other conference.
Well, at least they're buying tickets, so there you go.
Sure.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm very excited. It's an incredible lineup. I think it's really the first time this quality of speakers are coming together to talk really about a specific subject. So I think it's historic in that way, and I look forward to connecting in person. So
wonderful. Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a lot of fun. Everyone's real excited. There's already good energy. So, I mean, what can I say? It's going to be an eye-opening event, and there will be a sky watch, by the way. People going out with those goggle-type things to look for UFOs.
Oh, great.
And those are pretty commonplace, so they'll probably see some. And so if you don't want to hang around for the live music on Saturday night later on, you can basically go on the sky watch and have a lot of fun doing that. So, I mean, really, it's actually a very cool event. For me, my work is done more or less when the event starts. So I just kick back and just enjoy the experience.
Oh, good, good. I have to say about this interview, what I realize is that you were a lot more spiritually based and grounded in that awareness than I knew. So I'm very happy that's I just didn't know. I just,
No, I mean, I understand. Some people just have weird pictures of me. I actually started out in the spiritual side of things.
I'm happy.
I studied Eastern philosophy. I mean, this was my basis. I didn't actually come from sort of this side of things that I'm on now so much. But I really marry the two sides. I think it's really important to be earth-based and to sort of fight the good fight here. At the same time, I think, the name of the game is enlightenment.
Right. And I think that gives a solidity and a groundedness to Project Camelot as opposed to, just fighting the government and the matrix. I mean, there's this other awareness that seeps in that has a bigger framework for all this truth coming forward. And I think that's a very important part. And I'm happy that's there with you. So great.
Well, I'm happy it's there with you as well. And it's great we can connect on that level.
All right. So I look forward to seeing you on Friday. And if you need anything else, let me know. And again, The Awaken Aware, Time Travel in Other Worlds, 2013, awakenaware2013.net, with Carrie Cassidy and the Project Camelot. I'll be there doing some emceeing along with some amazing speakers, David Wilcox, Richard Hoagland, Preston Nichols, Sean David Morton. These are really the stars of our, I would call it, industry, you know? So thanks again. I know how much work it is to put these things on, and I'm you know, it's a lot. It's a pain.
Thanks, Alan. Well, you've been a great support in the, behind the scenes there, and I really do appreciate all of it. And it'll be a lot of fun to see you in person and have you join me on stage.
All right, great. I look forward to it, and I will talk to you soon. See you soon.
Okay. Take care.
Okay. I've been talking to Carrie Cassidy of the Project Camelot about her upcoming show. And I think it's going to be very exciting. It will be streamed live on Saturday and Sunday this coming weekend. You can look for that on the website, awakenaware2013.net. If you have any questions for me, you can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. You can also check my website, newrealities.com, for some upcoming events. I'll also be speaking at the Free Your Mind Conference in Philadelphia, April 25th, 26th, and 27th. And then I'll be heading down to Washington for the disclosure meetings, which I should have talked to Carrie about, that Stephen Bassett is doing, called Citizen Hearings, on April 29th to May 3rd. That is really going to stir up a lot of people. Thanks for listening tonight. And definitely email me comments, newrealities@earthlink.net. Otherwise, we'll see you out there. Thanks for listening.